In the 1970s, the tennis boom was in full swing in the United States, with major champions like Billie Jean King, Chris Evert, and Jimmy Connors becoming international celebrities. The sport gained popularity, and all over the country, tennis courts were built in city and county parks. With the passage of Title IX, women's sports began to grow in popularity on college campuses. Pat Brogdon joined the Campbell women's tennis team, which was not even a decade old in the fall of 1975. And by the time she graduated 3 years later, she was not only honored with Campbell's Outstanding Female Athlete Award, but also as one of the best college players in the state. After graduation, Pat embarked on a 30-year teaching and coaching career, and again proved to be one of the better athletes in the southeastern United States, but this time not in tennis. She swapped a tennis racket, picked up a golf club, and taught herself the game, and has become one of the most successful golfers in Carolina's Golf Association history. Along the way to a record 7 CGA senior titles, Pat had to overcome another obstacle, cancer. This past January, Pat was inducted into the Campbell Athletics Hall of Fame. My name is Stan Cole, class of 1987, and this is our next installment of Tales from the Creek, where we visit with the people who've made this place special over the years. I'm delighted to be joined today by Campbell Hall of Fame member Pat Brogdon. Welcome to Tales from the Creek, Pat, and thanks for taking the time to visit with us.
Well, thank you, Stan. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Pat, let's just start out at the beginning. Tell us about what it was like growing up in Eastern North Carolina and how you got started playing in sports.
Well, I grew up in Goldsboro. Lived there my entire life until I went to college. I was a little tomboy as a kid. I was the only one in the family that was anyway athletic. And my dad always wanted a left-handed ball player. And after my brother, I guess, disappointed him a little bit, he finally got one.
Mm-hmm.
And we played catch a little bit, and I was always sports-minded. And as I got older and got into school, I played athletics in middle school.
Mm-hmm.
There were not a lot of opportunities at the time. You know, basketball was about the only thing, you know, we could do. But I played it and excelled at it well. Same thing in high school. Not that many opportunities. Mainly played basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And one day a friend said, well, we need some people on the tennis team, so why don't you come out and play? And I said, well, you know, I don't have any racket. I don't have anything. I said, well, just come on. Just try it. And as it turns out, a cousin who lived with us for a little while had left a tennis racket at the house. And I mean one of those old-timey ones with the little square thing, the brace you put on it and turn the screws so that the wood won't warp. Mm-hmm. And I played with it for a little bit, and it wasn't good enough to really use. I have no idea how many years old it was. So I ended up going to the only sporting goods store we had in Goldsboro.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember now, tennis was big at this particular time. And the Farfours were big in tennis and
Right. Were
a well-known name.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the only sporting goods store. And it was called Music and Sports. So I go in there with, I don't know, $10, I guess, thinking, you know, I'll just get a little racket and a couple of balls and I'll go see what I can do. And I ask him, you know, what should I use? What should I get? And he takes me over in there. One of the cheaper models. I didn't want to spend a lot of money on it to start with. But as we're walking back to the counter, he kind of put his arm on my shoulder, and he says, now, you go practice and play hard, and if you get good enough, you can come play with my girls. Well, I think I was 16 years old at the time, but that kind of hit me wrong. I said, okay. I said, you don't know who you're talking to yet, but okay. And I ended up playing on the team and just loving the sport. I think I was 16, yes. So maybe my junior year, I ended up playing the number one position once I started playing a little bit. And within 3 years, I won the Goldsboro City Championship against his girls. And I kind of said, okay, so there. And right after that, funny thing, all of a sudden, you had to be a city resident to play in the city championship. Mm. You couldn't come in from outside of the county, which is where we lived at the time. So from there, I decided I wanted to do x-ray technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to, it was Johnson Technical Institute at the time, and they had just started this program. Mm-hmm. And I was still playing tennis all along. And when I, my second year, I decided I wanted to continue my education so that hopefully maybe I could come back and teach it.
Mm-hmm.
My instructor had said, you know, if I would do that, there would be a job for me. And Campbell was about the only place at the time that would accept all my credits. And money was going to be an issue. I mean, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. So she said, well, you play tennis. She said, let me talk to the coach and maybe you can try out and see. You know, it's a little bit of scholarship money, you know, would help. And I said, well, sure. I said, anything would help. So that's when I met Coach Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And I tried out for her, like I said, against, I assume, her number one player. And it was a very short match. And she offered me a scholarship on the spot. She said she had $1,000 and she'd give me $400. And that sounded like a lot of money to me. So I said, sure. And I played the number one position there for the 3 years that I attended.
So when you start out playing a junior in high school, and, you know, back then, you know, the sports that we got on TV, and I say we because we're in the same age group. You know, it was always the U.S. Open. It was Wimbledon. We had the Olympics. We had boxing, you know, a lot of things that you don't see necessarily on network all the time now. A cool thing is there's a tennis channel, and ESPN carries tennis matches from all over the world to us now. But, you know, we kind of saw the people who were playing on the weekends. Maybe the semifinals and finals were open. So, you know, I grew up being fascinated by the fact that Chris Everett hit a two-hand backhand. Mm-hmm. And I watched a lot of women's tennis. And then, you know, Jimmy Connors did the same on the men's side. Did you have any favorite players, anybody that you saw, or how did you develop your style?
Well, to begin with, I didn't have any style. I just hit the ball back if it came to me.
Right.
And I remember playing a match one day against some better players, and I liked how they looked hitting the ball, mm-hmm. you know, a little more finesse and whatever. So I said, that's how I want to hit it. I want to look better when I hit the ball. And at the time, as I said, we're living outside of the, out in the country kind of. But on one side of our house, there was just one window up in the corner, and it was on the driveway side. Mm-hmm. And I had about as big as this room, maybe. Space to hit a ball. Well, I played Billie Jean King. I played Chris Everett. You name it. I played everybody on the side of that house. Beat them all, of course.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But I cannot tell you the number of hours I spent playing tennis on the side of that house. Chris Everett was one of my favorites. And a story that some people know, but you may not know, the picture that you have for the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. The tennis dress that I'm wearing at the time, I made because Chris Everett had one just like it. And at the time, even back in the 70s, dresses like that would go for $40, $50.
Mm-hmm.
And I could make it for $7 or $8. And if you go back and look at some of her older pictures, you'll see a dress exactly like that with the three little stripes. I wanted it to be exactly like the one she wore.
As I recall, Chris Everett was an incredible competitor, but was not one that really showed her emotions on the court. She didn't let whether things were going too good or too poorly affect her incredible determination. Were you that way, or did your emotions come out more, or how would you describe your on court demeanor?
Very different than when I play golf. I was very stoic. Mm-hmm. Bjorn Borg was my model, and he didn't let you see anything.
Correct.
I never said a cuss word. I never let my emotions get to me. I remember one time playing with a guy, and he got a little mad, threw his racket, mm-hmm. and it went under the net to my side. And he said, would you hand me that racket, please? I said, no. I said, you come and get it.
Right.
And I was absolutely... No emotion. I tried to be a very good sport. But like I said, very different than when I play golf.
What style of play? Were you a baseline player, serving volley, a little bit of?
Not so much serving volley, but I never hit a two-hand backhand. Oh. It was always a one-hand backhand. Mm-hmm. I had a really good top spin forehand. Mm-hmm. I hit a good serve. Just an overall good game, but probably my forehand was the biggest. Learning top spin is what changed the game for me.
Right.
You know, being able to add that and a top spin serve. A lot of women were not doing that very well when I was playing.
So you said you spend thousands of hours, you know, hitting on your own backboard at home, so to speak. And I'm sure you found plenty of time to go play as well. What else did you do? Any part-time jobs, anything like that, that you did growing up besides school and tennis?
Well, I had two younger sisters, and both my parents were working, so I spent a lot of time taking care of them.
Right.
And as soon as I could drive, you know, it was me that took them everywhere.
Sure.
And did everything. My mom worked at, she was a nurse, and she worked at night. So I was kind of their caretaker. Once I felt comfortable enough with tennis, I started teaching tennis. And I remember taking a job out at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, and it was getting close to the time it was going to start. And I kind of said to myself, I said, I don't think you know how to do this. What to tell somebody what to do. And I remember going in buying a book and sat down, read it cover to cover so I could, you know, I didn't even know what to tell them about a grip or something. You know, I just knew how to play. So I started from there and I ended up teaching some group lessons and did more private lessons than anything. Goldsboro Country Club was kind enough back then to allow me to use their courts to teach some lessons because I was teaching some of their members. Mm-hmm. Had no idea there was a golf course behind me where I was teaching the lessons. But that was the main thing I did, yes, yes. And I could make pretty good money at it for that time.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, coming over and meeting Coach Lloyd and everything. Tell me a little bit about your memories of Frances. You know, she passed away just a few years ago, but, you know, Frances, Betty Jo Cleary, Wanda Watkins came, was in school with you. Mm-hmm. You know, some of our, you know, our pioneers in women's sports were on campus at the time that you were there. What do you remember a lot about Coach Lloyd?
Well, she was a special lady. She was a wonderful role model for us young girls. I don't know that she taught me a lot about tennis because mm-hmm. I was already at a level that, you know, hopefully I didn't need a lot of instruction. But she kind of wanted us to just drive the team and have a good time playing. That was the main thing. She wanted us all to get along and just have a good time. You know, she would set up our matches, who was going to play with whom and whatever. And I remember I actually, to our away matches, I drove the van. She'd sit in the back and she'd talk and laugh. And we'd have a good time with her. She was a very nice lady, a very special lady.
Well, and you can, you know, we all know how money drives athletics at the Division I college and then certainly the professional level now. The fact that she had a complete scholarship budget of $1,000 and to spend over probably 8 or 9, 10 players. Yes. And, you know, some of those, of course, would have been walk-ons, tells you probably what the expectations. So I think, you know, that was probably her charge was make sure they come here and get a degree and enjoy their time here as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What are some of your best memories while you're on campus, Pat?
Well, a lot of the friendships that I made, it was just a special time. The 70s were a great time to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Campbell was small. We could walk everywhere you needed to go. I mean, you didn't need a lot of money to do stuff. I mean, you know, if we wanted to eat out, we'd have to run down to Lillington, I guess, to the Hardee's, which was new then, I think. Just good times with friends. You know, I can't think of anything particularly special. I remember going to some of the shows, theater shows. They brought in some people. We had a bunch of us went to a Melissa Manchester concert.
Mm-hmm.
So they would bring in people. Just in general, you know, you felt safe. It was a good time to go to school.
while you were at Campbell, you were finished third in the 1977 AIAW state tournament, ranked among the top 10 players in North Carolina in singles and the top five in mixed doubles. Do you have any memories of that season that stand out in particular with you? I know you were undefeated in doubles with your partner, Brenda Matthews, correct?
Yes, that is correct. The main thing is that actually the one loss that I suffered was the main thing. And it was the absolute last match of the season. And I threw a ball up in the first set and pulled an abdominal muscle. Oof. And from then on, I could not reach up to hit the ball. And I think I won the first set. But from then on, I couldn't do anything above my head. And I managed to take the girl to three sets. I think it's somebody that I would have beaten in two sets had I been able to, and I would have had the undefeated season. But that sticks out of my mind more than anything, yeah. Yeah. But
did you have to just, you know, instead of serving, just hit a forehand, right?
And luckily, in the doubles match, you know, I only had to serve every fourth game.
Right.
So we were able, but that one went to three sets also, but we managed to pull it out.
What was your response when you were sitting there at the athletics banquet in 1978 and you were named Outstanding Female Athlete? Do you recall?
I do recall. I was sitting there and there were some very good basketball players at the time. Barbara Fox, Bonnie Hall, Wanda Watkins. And the girl was sitting beside me worked in the athletics department, so she knew who had won. Mm-hmm. And they were getting ready to announce it. And I just looked at her and I said, Barbara, get it again? And she looked at me with this kind of little grin, but not really a grin. I said, no. And I thought, well, I said, Wanda, Connie? And she's shaking her head, no. And all of a sudden I hear them call my name. And I was absolutely shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew I'd had a good season. But, you know, basketball was the sport then.
Sure.
You know. And I remember going down and getting in, just kind of being in a daze while they took pictures and whatever. It was definitely a highlight of my time there at Campbell.
You mentioned that you were, looking at a career in X-ray technology, but after you finish at Campbell, you go into the teaching and field. What prompted that?
They were killing me with science is what happened.
I joined the club.
They were absolutely guilty. Killing me with science. I did everything I could to pull two C's out of chemistry. Mm-hmm. And that was the first thing I took. And I said, this is not going to work.
Was that Dr. John?
I don't remember. I just remember it was the most miserable time of my life. I said, something's got to change. And I only wanted to get my teaching, you know, my 4-year and a teaching certificate so I could do it. And I ended up changing my major to physical education. Mm-hmm. And I needed one more year because I lost some of my credits once I did that. And when I graduated, I was going to take whichever job came up first, either teaching. I had done my student teaching and everything. Mm-hmm. I was going to take whichever job came up first. And a teaching job came up in Fayetteville at Ann Chestnut Junior High. And I took it and continued in teaching from then on.
Pat, you've had a firsthand seat to see the effects and the growth of women's athletics, and not just in the prize money thing, but just the opportunities. Mm-hmm. Campbell has 11 women's varsity sports now, you know, of its 21. And back, you know, even when I was in college, I started in fall of 83, there was cross country, there was basketball, slow pitch softball, tennis, and track and field. The volleyball team hadn't started. The soccer team hadn't begun yet. What has it been like to be a part and to personally see the growth of women's athletics, not only in our country, but around the world?
Oh, it's just amazing. It doesn't seem so strange to me because I was always athletic. That was what I wanted to do, always. You know, my sister played the piano. No, I wanted sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted as many opportunities as possible. And like I said, in middle school, high school, you didn't have many chances. But you didn't have, in the time that we lived in, you didn't have as many women who wanted to do that.
Right.
And as that has, we've seen that grow, you know, then the level of sports. I think field hockey was also something they
picked
up then.
For a couple of years, they sure did.
But other than that, you just didn't have that much to choose from. It's amazing. It should have been that way all along. And that's what the girls will tell you now. They just want an opportunity.
I remember talking with Wanda during one of these podcasts and with Rhonda Muller Langdon Johnson, and their heroes growing up in basketball were all male.
Mm-hmm.
Their pattern, Wanda was a Dean Smith disciple, and so it was Carolina men's basketball that she watched. Uh-huh. She didn't have that role model. And, you know, increasingly since the 70s, there have been more role models for young women to pattern their games after or to see and to say, oh, I want to be like fill in the blank, Mia Hamm or anyone like this. And, you know, I think that's one thing that never occurred to me growing up because, you know, I collected football cards and baseball cards and saw the players on the, and I think, well, you know, these are the athletes. But then you come to work in the field for so long, and that was probably the last thing that I understood about the whole process was it wasn't just that there was not as many sporting opportunities or playing competitive opportunities, but there were fewer role models. And and I had never even considered that.
Yes.
Pat, I always like to ask this question. You mentioned Mr. Farfour and Goldsboro, but who are some of the people who helped you along the way to get where you started or to get to college and then beyond?
There aren't a lot. I've pretty much done what I've done on my own. My parents allowed me to do what I wanted to do.
Right.
But they weren't at every match. My mother never saw me play tennis till I was in college. Mm-hmm. I mean, she worked. I understand.
Sure.
But pretty much what I've tried to do in my athletics and in my life, I've done on my own. You know, there have been principals who've given me an opportunity at a job or something. But for the most part, being the only athletic person in my family, you know, it was just me playing on the side of the house by myself.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea where your competitive drive came from?
I don't know, but it was there from the start.
Because always you hear things about a younger sibling and wanting to be like so-and-so in the family or some of the kids on the block or something like that.
Well, my brother was older, but he had some physical problems, and it's not like we could play together sports-wise. And part of the problem was I was a better athlete than most of the people I was playing with, and a lot of those were guys.
Right.
So I played a lot of tennis on the side of the house by myself.
And I'll tell you this, and this is from personal shared experience. My wife, Claudia, a great athlete, she was faster than all the other boys around. And they didn't take kindly to that, to being shown up by a girl when they were 10 years old, which was, I find, it makes me kind of proud. And she's very competitive in things that she does, but she only grew up around boys. She didn't. There were no other girls her age in the little small town that she grew up with. So I'm curious about that. So you play college tennis, you graduate, you go get a job. When did you decide to start playing golf?
Well, I continued tennis. I was in Fayetteville for 5 years. I continued tennis the whole time I was there. But I was playing competitively less and less. Mm-hmm. I think I just kind of got burned out on it after playing it and then teaching it all the time.
Right.
And I just wanted to do something different. By that point, I had injured my knee 4 times in 4 different sports. And I'm trying to find something maybe I can not get hurt in. So I kind of backed off tennis and I played softball for a year. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I'm jumping out of the way of a ball getting hit at me and I injured the knee again in my 5th sport. So at that point, I said, I've got to come up with something that maybe I won't get hurt. And I've been injured more in golf than anything. more things have happened to me on the golf course. But a friend of mine, I was down at the beach with her family, and we went to a little par three. And I had hit a golf ball around. My dad, you know, he wanted me to do sports. Mm-hmm. So he got me a little golf club and some little wiffle balls, and I'd hit them around the yard. But to play, I said I never would because it was the laziest sport I'd ever seen, you know, when I'm playing tennis. So we go down and we go to this little par three. And I guess on the first swing, I just hit it, you know, right in the sweet spot. And I was hooked. That was all it took. That was all it took was one swing. And then from then on, that was all I wanted to do.
Now, you went and played. Did they have left-handed clubs for you there?
They did, yes, yes. But it was par three, so you just needed a couple of irons. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, relatively few left-handed golfers as opposed to right-handed golfers mm-hmm. in the world. Not to mention cross-handed playing yes. golfers. How did you come up with this very unique style that you have?
I don't know that's anything I came up with. It's just the first time as a little kid I picked up a softball bat. I was going to bat cross-handed, and that's what I did. And a little story once while I was at Campbell, Coach Danny Roberts, who coached mm-hmm. basketball team for years, he was teaching a PE major's golf class. And, of course, it's the first day, and he's going around showing everybody, you know, this is how you grip it. You can do this, this, or this. And he gets to me, and I'm doing this with not just a cross-handed grip, but a 10-finger grip.
Right.
You know, no overlap, nothing.
Like holding a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And he said, well, that's not how you hold it. I said, well, I'm sorry, Coach. I said, that's how I hold it. He said, well, you are never going to be able to play the game that way. So I said, okay, Coach, that's fine. Well, funny thing, I saw him a few years later after I'd started playing. He was doing a book signing or something, I think, at one of the golf shops. And I reminded him of our conversation. And strangely, he didn't seem to remember it. Okay, well, there.
When did you start entering tournaments, in golf tournaments, you think, after you go down the par three and you get hooked?
Yeah, that's the thing. I knew I wanted to play competitively.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess within 3 years I was doing like the Wake County Open or, you know, whatever was local around there at the time. The problem was working. I could only play some things in the summertime.
Right.
And I just learned, I don't know, word of mouth, friends here or there, you know, well, you need to come play in this. You need to come do this. Well, where is it? Why do you do it? What do you do? Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't understand anything about the process. Same thing with tennis. I had no idea how to get into competitive tennis.
Right.
But I eventually started playing some things, and it really didn't take off until I retired. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference in playing on weekends and being able to play 4 or 5 times a week.
Certainly.
And when I could play more of the season that I needed to once I retired, and that's been 17 years ago now, mm-hmm. My game really took off. And I did most of what I have done in my senior career, you know, since I retired.
I just spoke with Jimmy Gerken, who was an All-American golfer at Campbell in the late 60s. And he said his secret, similar to what you did on by hitting the tennis ball for hours on end, he said at some point in time in his career, he was hitting 1,000 wedges a day and putting until the sun went down. Your golfing resume is impressive. 18 total Carolinas Golf Association championships, including a record 7 senior championships, a North and South Super Senior Championship title at Pinehurst number 2, and 20 holes in one. Are you kidding? I don't know that I've had 20 holes in one in putt-putt.
21 now, thank you.
Okay, well, this is updated since the this is 6 months. Okay, so she's had another hole in one since January. What's your secret?
I was doing an interview one time after one of my tournaments, and the girl asked me, she said, how do you stay in the game? I had a huge lead going into the final day. Mm-hmm. She said, how do you keep your focus, and what do you do when you've got that big a lead and you know you could, you know, almost fall down and still win it? I said, I don't want to win by 10 if I can win by 11. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to win by 11 if I can win by 12. I said, that's how. I used to go out in the middle of the day when nobody else was playing, 95, 98 degrees, and I would play to practice. I would play from three different sets of tees on each hole, and I had to par every ball or I couldn't go to the next hole. And there was nobody around, so sometimes I could take my time.
Sure.
And I would play a red tee, a gold tee, a white tee. So sometimes I'd be playing like a par three anywhere from 110 all the way up to 170, 180. Well, I got to that par three one day, and it was like the number six hole. So I've already been out there for over an hour. Mm-hmm. Playing every hole, got a par every hole. I had to play that hole seven times before I could move to the next one. But I did, because I will not take no for an answer.
So it sounds like you're competing against yourself as much as the field,
yes,
right?
Yes, in golf you are.
You against the course, you against the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is the strongest part of your game?
I think my driver is my most consistent club. Mm-hmm. But if you ask anybody else, they'll say my short game.
Mm-hmm.
Short game and putting.
Tell us about your, circle back a little bit, your teaching career. 30 years in the public schools. That's a long time. What was it that kept you coming back year after year?
The 5 years in Fayetteville were tough. Mm-hmm. You know, I was right out of school, didn't know anybody, whatever. I had been trying to get into Wake County, you know, those 5 years, because I did my student teaching there and I wanted to go back to Wake County. But I did 5 years of teaching there and coached. The first year, that principal made me coach every sport.
Mm-hmm.
Assist, unpaid. I had to assist every sport. And it was the best thing for me, you know, just to learn for the experience. But that was a tough year. I never had a day off, really.
Right.
I made my way to Raleigh, and I taught at that same school for the other 25 years of my career. I don't know that I wanted to stay into teaching for that long, but about 10 years into my teaching career, that's when I was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time. And you get locked into the healthcare.
Right.
At that point, until I had been like cancer free for 10 years, nobody was going to insure me.
Sure.
So at that point, I'd get to 20. Well, if you do 20, you have to go ahead and do your 30.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened for me. I retired way earlier than any of my friends. Now, I never made any money in my life teaching school, but, you know, this time that I've had retired has been just absolutely wonderful.
Our guest today on Tales from the Creek is Campbell Hall of Fame member Pat Brogdon. Pat, now that you've retired from teaching, how do you like to spend your time? Obviously, you still put a lot of work into your golf game.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll play 5 or 6 days a week. And, you know, it's nothing for me to play 10 or 12 days in a row, depending on the weather or, you know, if I'm getting ready for a tournament or something. I enjoy cooking. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of that. Golf trips with my friends, you know, that are not, you know, tournament type golf. I take care of my own house and home and yard and everything. I like to do that. I'm not a big sit-down person and read, you know. I have to be doing something. But
well,
trips back and forth to Goldsboro. My sister, that's all that's left of our family now is my sister and I. So trips down there to visit her and travel a little bit.
You mentioned your first bout with cancer.
Yes.
Do you mind sharing with us a little bit about that experience? And I'm curious, do you feel like your competitive nature in athletics helped you in that? Because people describe battling cancer. It's a battle. Does that help you?
Yes, it definitely helped. I was 33 years old and I started seeing some blood in my urine, and I went for a checkup. And the guy said, you know, I think it's just an infection. Here, take this antibiotic. And I was leaving for a trip. He said, when you come back, you need to make an appointment. So I had a friend recommend a guy to me, or a urologist. And I went into him, and he immediately saw the tumor in the bladder. Mm-hmm. And he said it was the size of his thumb, and that's what was bleeding. So it turned out it had invaded the muscle wall. At that point, I'm stage 4, It's called transitional cell cancer. It's a very fast growing, fast spreading. And they had to remove my bladder completely. And at the time they do, there were two doctors on the East Coast who could do the kind of surgery I needed. And one of them happened to be at Duke.
Wow.
They do a surgery where they take part of your small intestine, they remove the bladder completely, mm-hmm. they take part of your small intestine, make a pouch,
mm-hmm.
everything's inside, and they staple it to your abdominal wall. And then they run a little passageway up to an outside hole in my abdomen, and then you put a catheter in to empty your pouch.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, I can't go. Everything was fine with that. They said if it spread, they thought they had it all. Everything looked good. If it spread, it would go to my lungs. So every 3 months, I was having chest x-rays. Mm-hmm. And about the third one in, they saw a spot. And I had to do, at that point, what they call a thin needle aspiration, where they put a needle into the lung and take some tissue out. And sure enough, it had spread. And I was absolutely devastated. I mean, I thought everything was cool. Everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one time they caught me off guard, and I said, that'll never happen again. So I ended up having to go through 6 rounds of some of the most intensive chemotherapy you will ever see in your life. My competitive nature is what kept me going. I would go into the hospital and get all 4 drugs at one time and spend overnight. And by the time they gave me the 4th, when I was so sick at that point, I'd spend just the whole night throwing up. I'd leave the next morning, and sometimes I would go straight to the golf course. And I'd play 9 holes because I knew by the next day I was not even going to be able to stand up. And they'd give me a week off. Then I would take 3 drugs 1 week, 3 drugs the next week, and then you start the whole thing over again, back in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I did okay till about the 4th treatment. And then one of the side effects of the drugs is you can get mouth sores.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean like a little one, you know, like you might get ever so often. My mouth would be completely covered all the way down your esophagus. I mean, I'd wake up in the middle of the night, my lips would be caked in blood. And that was the one time, one night, that I said, I don't think I can go through this anymore. But I did, and the next day, you know, I managed to do what I needed to do. Still had 2 more treatments. And I remember going to the doctor and saying, he said, you lost like 10 pounds. He said, you've got to do this. You got to do this. I said, I couldn't put anything in my mouth. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know how this would be any worse. And he said, well, it could. At that point, I said, oh, my God. But I managed to get through the two more treatments and was cancer-free completely until the breast cancer 2 years ago. But an interesting story that will tell you that you can't say that God's not present somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going through the chemotherapy, the doctor that I had was a gentleman who had come down from Pittsburgh. And his name was Donald Trump. But everybody called him Skip. I don't think he wanted to be called Donald Trump. With a specialty in my cancer. He had just come to Duke. He treated me through that experience. And 2 months after, he did follow up. And right after that, he went right back to Pittsburgh. I don't think he had ever left that area before. Now, you tell me God didn't send that man to me?
He was put in your path.
He was. He was. And it's the only reason I'm alive now, is him and Duke.
Well, and I would add to that, you know, from the people that I've known that have gone through this, they say the drugs are there to kill the cancer, and hopefully they don't kill you along the way. Surely the fact that you had been an athlete for
yes.
decades and had kept your body in such good
yes.
condition would enabled you your body to endure that.
Well, they say a healthy cancer cell will take in more of the drugs. So the better condition you are in physically, you know, the better it is. And I think that's why. I had a 30% chance of getting in remission. 30%.
But that's all you need, right?
Well, apparently. And like I said, I've been cancer-free up until the breast cancer 2 years ago. Now, I've had 5 different surgeries related to the original surgery. And I get infections in the pouch, which is just normal for that type of surgery and living with this. I'm one of his oldest living patients. So they're still learning things about the original surgery. They don't even do it this way anymore. But they learn something every year that I stay alive about the pouch and, you know, what can happen with it.
Does that help you understand that, you know, we all are put on this earth for a reason? And do you ever feel like, you know, what I've gone through and what I've endured is helping them learn how to help someone else later on?
Well, not just that. In the beginning, when I had had the original surgery, I would go back and talk to ladies who were getting ready to have this same surgery, who were just absolutely devastated, you know, at the change it was going to be in their body.
Right.
I mean, this is a life-changing operation.
Sure.
So, I mean, if I could help somebody else get through it, then I guess there's a reason it happened to me. But I don't question that. Whatever happens, I just do it and move on.
It's kind of like if you hit it in the rough and the ball's sitting in a 3-inch rough, you just got to get out of it, right?
Yeah, you just and then move on to the next thing. Because with me, unfortunately, something's going to happen.
Pat, I always like to ask this question to people who are experienced and have gone through some things. But what advice would you give to a young player who wants to compete at the college level?
Well, work on being a good person first. And that will make whatever you do in sports easier. And I try to do that. I want to be remembered as a good person first. If you played a round of golf with me, I want to know at the end of the day, you feel like you had a nice day. Now, I probably took some money off of you, but I hope you had a nice day. But you have to be committed, to be committed to something. You know, you can't just go out there and, you know, hit a few balls around and expect things to fall in your lap. You have to advocate for yourself. You know, we just don't live in a world where people are going to hand you things. But kids today don't want to work hard either. And that's what it takes. If you want to excel at golf, you have to work. There's just no substitute.
Pat, last January, you were inducted into the Campbell Athletics Hall of Fame. What does that honor mean to you?
I don't know if I can express in words. I never expected it. You know, I look back and I felt like I had a pretty good career, and I know I've had a good career in golf. But to be recognized as one of the top in anything, I mean, at a whole university, you know, the number of people that have come through and played sports, and it's just amazing. It's just amazing.
Let's wrap up with a few questions I always like to ask my friends in golf. Who makes up your ideal foursome? Now, you can extend it to 5 if you want to, you know, to include you if you want to put. But
my ideal foursome, well, it'd have to be my best friend, Angela. We play a lot of four-ball together.
And this can be anybody. It can be Abraham Lincoln, anybody,
yeah,
living
or
dead.
I'm trying to think. Corey Webb has always been a role model of mine. Mm-hmm. People don't realize she's the only one who won all 5 majors at the time. I don't know if I'd throw somebody young in there. Probably Nelly Korda. Mm-hmm. That'd be good enough. I enjoy most anybody I play with, you know.
What's the most difficult course you've played?
Most difficult. Probably Pinehurst number 2.
Right.
Yeah.
How about, do you have a favorite golf course?
An absolute favorite. I don't know. I like number 4 a lot. They're also different. It's hard to say. It's hard to say.
Do you have a course on your golfing bucket list that you want to play that you haven't played yet?
Well, Pebble Beach probably always comes to mind first, yeah.
Do you have a favorite golfing memory?
Golfing memory. Probably the first time I shot my age.
Wow.
I was 64 years old. And I've done it every year since.
I shoot my age every time I play it, unfortunately, but then I always have a few holes or more, some more to go, but that's incredible. Are there any golfers that you really like to watch play either now or in the past?
Oh, I was a Tiger fan from day one. I'm so glad I got to see him play in his peak years. This young girl who's number one right now, Geno Titical. Mm-hmm. I really like her swing. And if some female golfers want to emulate someone, she's got it. It's very simple. But that's about it. My swing is so unorthodox compared to, you know, what would be considered velvety or smooth.
What's the best bit of advice that golf-wise that you've ever heard?
I guess stay in the moment. Just take the one shot. You know, you hear it all the time, people say, but you really have to. You can't look ahead. You can't worry about what happened, you know, on the last hole. Just stay in the moment of the shot you're hitting right then and be committed to it. You can get as mad as you want to for a second, but when it's time to stand over the ball, commit to the shot.
Finally, Pat, can you put into words how Campbell University and this community have impacted your life?
Man, that's hard to say. Such a long time ago. But I know a lot of who I am and what I want to be or try to be is because I was here first. You know, they tried to give you values and somebody was always looking out for you. It was just a good time to be in school, and it made me want to give some of that back.
I'm Stan Cole, and our guest today on Tales from the Creek has been Campbell Hall of Fame member Pat Brogdon. Thank you, Pat, for sharing your Tales from the Creek.
Thank you, Stan. Pleasure to be here.